It's deja vu. This moment's happened before.
You have found the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Hello, and welcome to the Kaleidoscope Gallery. I'm your host, Paul, and alongside contributors Dave, Autumn, and Hans, we will be exploring time travel, spinning the universe and parallel universes, a controversial list of the world's best cuisines, Canadian cuisine versus world cuisine, which would win, and the AI chatbot ChatGPT versus humans, who would win. So let's step into the first exhibit inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
I'm more excited about the ingredients here. Greece never gets the look in that France has, or the Italians. Honestly, I think Greek cuisine is better than Italian cuisine.
No, you're not serious. Say something.
The thing is, in Crete, for example, yeah, this is one place in the world where people live up to 90, 100 years old here, and that's because of the food and the climate. The
Italian diet is one of the most famous diets in the world for people living many, many years.
They live longer here in Greece.
Sima, you cannot compare it to.
A new ranking of the world's best cuisines has divided and apparently baffled internet users after the United States was ranked ahead of France. Food website Taste Atlas, which describes itself as a world atlas of traditional dishes, local ingredients, and authentic restaurants, shared the ranking of 95 best world cuisines on its Twitter account on Thursday.
It's an article in it's called TasteAtlas.com, and it claims to have surveyed its readers, and for the world's best cuisines, and they've ranked them, and they've given out awards, Taste Atlas awards, world's best cuisines, and so they rank it from number one all the way to.
So I'm guessing one is Italian.
Okay, that's a very good guess. Number one voted is Italian.
Number two, maybe French?
Well, number two is listed as Greek cuisine.
Oh, Greek?
Yeah.
Mediterranean's up there, though, right? That's where it's at. Is it Lebanon third?
Third is Spanish cuisine.
I don't know if I agree with that. I find it a little greasy.
So you've been to Spain then, right?
Yes, been many, many years ago. Barcelona Olympics.
Barcelona. And you went to the Barcelona Olympics?
Yeah, I didn't win gold, but I went. I didn't win anything, really, except one of the best times. It was long nights on La Rambla.
When you think of Spanish cuisine, what do you think of?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think of like little tapas, like sausages pre-chopped up and served to you in like an infused oil or something. And maybe some really nice croquettes. They do great croquettes, but usually filled with ham and cheese, which they're delicious. And then a lot of seafood, a lot of like octopus and chunks of fish from their bountiful supply. But then there's also that strange thing that on the, like, it's like rice on a iron skillet. What's that called?
Is that paella?
Maybe it's paella, yeah.
Hello? It's not possible.
What?
It's not possible for me. Please come.
What is it?
It's Terry, please come.
Look, I'm busy.
No, he tell me. I not know to make a paella. He tell me.
You tell him.
I tell him paella is a Spanish, not Cockney stinking eel pie.
Right.
I make the paella like my mama.
I'm not interested.
My mother's recipe is big in Barcelona.
No way. Please, you come.
Do you think on this list, do you think British cuisine is going to appear anywhere on this list? Or
maybe 200 or so? French has got to be up there. Where does Chinese and where does Japanese sit?
Japanese makes the list at number 4. Next in line is in number 5 is Indian cuisine.
Very complex and wonderful flavors. And keep in mind that butter chicken is not Indian cuisine.
British Indian food or British Indian pub food is mainly what Indian food in North America is as well. It's British style.
I think that's right. Yeah, I think they took the curry to a whole different level.
Going for an Indian or having a curry is almost as stereotypically British as roast dinners or fish and chips. There are around 12,000 curry houses in Britain. Curry in its 1970s form was cheap and cheerful, adapted for British tastes. A classic example of an Indian dish, buttered chicken, meeting British tastes, in this case with the addition of cream and allegedly cream of tomato soup.
The next one is Mexican cuisine's number 6. Of course, that's kind of obvious because everyone loves, especially hard shell tacos. I don't know, those are my favorite. The way they just crunch, but they do collapse quite easily.
There's a technique to eating them. You got to tilt your head to the side, and then you can eat a taco without it falling apart. A hard shell. I also don't believe hard shell tacos are really a thing in Mexico.
Like the hard shell tacos are really like an invention of old El Paso.
How to turn an ordinary old day into old El Paso taco night filled with taco night. With the old El Paso taco dinner kit has what it takes to transform an ordinary old day into taco
night. Clocking in at number 7 is Turkish cuisine.
I love Turkish cuisine. The Turkish pizza is one of my favorite things. The pide, they call it. Oh, it's fabulous. It's like, it looks like a canoe. It's folded in on the sides. The cheese is still delightful, but sometimes there's not even cheese. Like, you can just get like little ground meats and tomatoes. My favorite one is the cheese with the Turkish sausage, like a good lamb sausage. Fucking fantastic.
Like, to wrap out the top 10, you have, next would be American cuisine. Then you've got your French cuisine at number 9. And finally, number 10 is Peruvian cuisine.
Peruvian, okay.
And, I mean, this was voted on by the readers of this one particular outlet.
They may not have access. That's one thing about Toronto. I think we really do have excellent selection of authentic worldwide cuisine. I got to admit, I don't know how many times I've eaten Peruvian. Maybe once. I shouldn't really. Oh, have you ever had a pupusa?
That sounds familiar.
They used to sell them in Kensington Market. This old woman was cooking them in the back of a grocery store on like a flatbed fryer, you know, one of those like little griddles you can buy, plug-in griddles.
Oh, wow.
She was flipping pupusas, stuffing them by hand. Oh, my goodness, they were good.
This wasn't really a proper kitchen. It was just like,
she was just making pupusas in the back, just slapping together that corn dough or whatever, filling it up with cheese and pork, frying it, and then handing it to you with like this delightful kind of coleslaw, almost sauerkraut, and a delightful tomato sauce. It was just a wonderful thing to eat. I don't know if you can still get them. Pupusa, let's just figure out what country that's from. El Salvador, yeah, El Salvador. It's a cornmeal cake stuffed with meat, beans, and cheese. Oh, they're good. I want one right now.
Pizza has got to be the world's most popular food, do you think?
I think every culture has something like that, yeah. Basically, bread, toppings, oven, magic.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves pizza, the worldwide taste treat. Yes, everybody loves pizza. Join the crowd headed for the snack bar, where everybody orders that delicious, wholesome, taste-tempting pizza.
Canadian cuisine. Out of 95, do you care to guess where it placed approximately?
70?
Yeah. It places on this list at 92.
Oh, okay.
The best rated foods being Oka cheese.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yukon Gold potatoes.
No, that's good.
Maple syrup.
Come on.
Two things close to your heart, Dave, I know. Montreal style bagel.
And smoked meat.
And Montreal smoked meat.
So I'd say that list makes Canada better than England. Like, if I had to pick to eat only the foods on one of those lists, I would definitely take maple syrup over Worcester. I'd definitely take smoked meat sandwich from Schwartz's over toffee pudding or whatever.
Everything there, apart from maybe the Yukon Gold, is like a Montreal thing. Like the Montreal bagel, the Montreal smoked meat, the maple syrup, the Oka cheese. You know what? Hands down, I have to say Montreal is phenomenal with food. And it provides, I would have to say, quite a nicely diverse selection of different types of food. Great bagels, you know, poutines, and Canadian fare. Poutine is very Canadian. Poutine would be a Canadian thing, right?
Yeah, So they also have a list of the best Canadian dishes. And number one on the list is, as you predicted, Autumn, poutine. And number two, the second best dish in Canada is Hawaiian pizza.
So, look, it's an American-style pie topped with cheese. So, is it Canadian or is it American?
Apparently, it was invented in Canada.
Oh, was it? I thought it was an American style. Okay, anyways.
It's now one of the most common pizza toppings. But it wasn't back in the 60s. Greek immigrant Sam Panopoulos owned a restaurant in Chatham, Ontario. He saw some pineapple on the shelf and decided to give it a try, as he told CBC Radio's As It Happens.
Tried to make some pizza, and then along the way, threw some pineapples on it, and nobody liked it at first, you know, but after that, they went crazy about it. Mm-hmm. Because those days, nobody was mixing sweet and sour.
Decades later, his creation has spread around the world.
Okay, back to this list here. Number three, pancakes with maple syrup. Number four, uramaki sushi. Number five, Kraft dinner.
Okay.
Number six, butter tarts. And let's skip to number 10 here.
Whatever, Timbits. Good God. Really?
Where do you go when the kids are in tow and you hear that old refrain?
Where are we, Dad?
You look in your pocket and all that you've got is $2 to your name. That's easy. Go for Timbits, go for Timbits. That's Tim Hortons today. With 10 fresh flavors every day, everyone can have their way. Yeah! You've always got time for Timbits.
What's your favorite kind?
Donut holes. From Tim Hortons. Also very popular at office parties. But going further down this list, number 14, we have Nanaimo bars. A chocolatey dessert treat from Nanaimo in BC. Then number 15, we have pemmican.
Pemmican is made of dried meat mixed with rendered fat. The dried powdered meat could be buffalo, could be moose, it could be elk, deer, and that would keep at room temperature, and it could actually last for about 4 years, so it was an excellent survival food. But it became important for the explorers and the voyageurs and the Métis and the indigenous people at the time to ensure their survival.
Number 23, we have beaver tails.
That's totally legit, too. I've had beaver tails before.
Beaver tails are sweet, flat, and thin Canadian pastries made from whole wheat flour.
Yeah, it's just like flat dough and like deep fried and then brown sugar and
and the dough is shaped to look like a beaver's tail. And further down the list, number 32, we run into the infamous turducken. Turducken.
Tarducken. What's tarducken? Is it duck?
No, it's...
It's an American-Canadian dish consisting of deboned turkey.
Turkey.
Deboned duck and deboned chicken rolled into one.
Several people have claimed bragging rights for the creation of the turducken. A Bear's Specialty Meats in Maurice, Louisiana is one of them.
There's a lot of people that say that they were the first one to make it. We opened during the holiday season in 1985. An old farmer walked in. I don't know to this day who he was. He just walked in with a turkey, a duck, and a chicken that he had killed out of his backyard.
The farmer asked Hebert to debone the birds and put the smaller ones inside the turkey, along with some sausage dressing.
I thought he was crazy asking for that, but we did it. He ended up not being crazy.
So it's a duck that's been stuffed with turkey and chicken meat. It's very cannibalistic, yeah.
It's a lot.
It's a lot of meat, yeah.
There's a lot going on with the turducken. Do you think there could ever be a vegetarian version of the turducken? Tofu ducken? As we get further down this list from tasteatlas.com, number 37 of best Canadian dishes is Pizza Getty. Pizza Getty is a Quebec dish consisting of a combination of pizza and spaghetti, hence the name.
Wow, that's a lot of dough. And this is a lot of starch. And Windsor-style pizza looks like nothing.
Okay, number 39, Windsor-style pizza from Windsor, Ontario. It's a thing, though. I lived in Windsor.
It's a thing, eh?
I can tell you, it is a vibe.
Oh, okay.
The oven heats up, the pizza goes in, and the countdown is on. John Palmer has waited years for this moment. What's another 30 minutes?
I grew up in Windsor, and I always had fond memories of my childhood.
This pizza is one of them.
The sauce, the cheese, pepperoni, canned mushrooms.
To taste is another. Palmer picked the spot.
Antonino's original pizza.
And placed the order. The next day, after a nearly 4,000-kilometer journey, it was mission accomplished.
You got to be real hardcore Windsor pizza fans to pay $350 to have 10 large pizzas shipped.
Antonino's has shipped to other parts of Canada and the U.S. and has recently received international requests.
We actually got a call saying, hey, I'm calling from Dubai. I want 2 medium pizzas shipped out here. And I honestly thought it was a joke.
No, just seriously, good pizza.
What are some of the most exotic to you, dishes that you've ever eaten?
My friend always tries to get me to push my limits. So he takes me out for monkfish liver. I don't know if you've ever looked at the monkfish. It's probably the ugliest creature on the planet.
Monkfish. Also known as the angler, the monkfish is probably one of the ugliest delicacies you'll ever encounter. Much of its body is made of the head, with the remaining part being much like an afterthought.
And I ate its liver like multiple times. It's a winter delicacy in Japan. It was delicious. But the monkfish is some kind of monster, man.
Oh, is it a large fish?
It's huge. Nasty. Whew. It's flat. Flat with a giant ugly head like it was poorly evolved. And it's kind of slimy. Are you seeing the pictures?
Yeah, I am. I am seeing the pictures. It looks
It looks like it's been run over or something.
According to the Food Network, it has a mild, sweet flavor without a trace of fishiness.
Oh, it's quite delightful.
Like lobsters and...
Lobster's nasty. Come on, it's a giant insect at the bottom of the ocean. And then people just drench it in clarified butter like insane people.
To make it taste good.
Well, it doesn't taste bad. It does kind of taste sort of sweet, but it's also just the idea of, and there's so little meat, so much shell and bone, and you're cracking shell and bone. You get like one bite out of it. You drench it in butter to try to get some calories out of it. And the whole practice of like putting the lobsters in a tank and then you pick the one you want them to kill to Like, that's really nasty.
Well, you might as well get to know it a little bit.
Oh, the people who buy them live and then throw them in the boiling water and watch them boil to death. Like, that's supposed to be a way to impress a girl, right? Oh, come on over. Oh, look at this creature. Oh, let's see how long it takes it to boil to death.
I've never stepped inside a Red Lobster in my life. I heard a story that you could, like, hear the lobster screaming from the kitchen. Is that...
No. That's the popcorn shrimp. What a way to die, man. There's no dignity in becoming popcorn. If I'm a shrimp, and I know mostly I'm food in the ecosystem, I'm like, eat me whole. Do not batter me and pop me like I'm at KFC or the movies or something. Just for an excuse to put more clarified butter on.
You are inside the Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Dudley, you must be mad. A time machine.
Yes, my friend, a time machine.
This thing?
This very thing.
This contraption? This framework made of quartz and bronze and ivory, with its levers and its dials, and this is the result of 3 years' hard work.
I promise you, Father, that on this machine a man can go wherever he likes in time.
Oh, really, old man?
Time is only a kind of space. If we can move about in all the other dimensions of space, why not in time, too?
It's impossible. It's out of the question.
Then what of the journeys I have already taken on this little contraption?
I'm afraid you've been having a bad dream.
You shall have proof, my friend.
How?
Just climb on, Fowler, and I'll take you for a little spin.
Okay, here's an article in sciencealert.com. Headline is, traveling back in time is possible inside universes that spin. It goes on, it turns out that time travel into the past is actually relatively easy. All you need to do is make the universe rotate. And this is a theory from mathematician Kurt Gödel. But according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, time travel into the past is forbidden. It's not possible. Gödel discovered that actual general relativity is perfectly fine with time travel into the past. The trick is to set the universe in motion.
Universes that spin. Okay, so time and space are interrelated, right? So, I don't know. I'm not a physicist, but I mean, it seems like a very elementary way of proposing this, right? Like, okay, go back in time, so spin the universe so you can go back to that point in time. It's all fine and dandy to propose theories for things, right? Like time travel and whatnot. But I think the article also examines, well, what would logically happen if you were to propose time travel going back in time. And it makes sense. There will be. You would be creating paradoxes. The theory makes sense for maybe inanimate objects, but I don't know about, like, living things that have, you know, they have lifespans, right? So, like, you know, we have lifespans, we change, we grow, like, so for us to try and attempt to go back to, then the paradox would be me looking at my old self, which is a paradox in itself. I don't know if two beings can exist in one time.
Yeah, and also if you went back into the past, you'd have foreknowledge of the future, which was your past present.
Never mind the thoughts, but just your physical being looking at yourself, who is the younger you. Again, that in itself is a paradox. You as the same individual cannot exist in two separate types of states in the same time frame. Do you know what I mean? So the question is, why would you go back in time, right? Are you saving the world? Are you like what? Are you doing like a? Are you pulling like a what's his face in Terminator? Because if you endeavor to go back in time, so technically You're going back in time as your current self, observing or being present in that old timeline. Paradoxes happen when you try to influence that timeline, right? And it changes the future. It's just not realistic. It's not going to happen.
But this theory suggests that if you could spin the universe, which is something that's very hard to conceive how you would do that, but then you could travel back in time. But that's quite the trick, because according to most observations, the universe is static. To get around your paradox problem, Autumn, of time travel, what if when you traveled backwards in time by spinning the universe, you ended up in a parallel universe? A universe parallel to our own, so that would mean you wouldn't cause all those time disruptions.
It was one of the scientific sensations of the year 2020. For the first time, evidence was presented for the existence of a parallel universe. As though that weren't enough, the universe was described precisely. It is said to have originated at the same time as our universe and to be a direct mirror of it. That means that, from our point of view, time runs backwards in the parallel universe. If you assume this theory comes from unserious, tinfoil hattists or conspiracy theorists, you're wrong. Because none other than NASA scientists have presented this sensational thesis.
In a parallel universe, would your Netflix password be the same, or it would be different, right? Or I guess you'd just type it in reverse?
I don't know if it necessarily creates a parallel universe. But first of all, my thing is, I didn't think the universe was static. Or maybe this is just a theory that it's an expanding universe, right? I think that is just one theory. Nobody really knows. There's like orbital movements of planets around and moons around planets, etc., right? So there's movement in our galaxy. But so because there is movement in our galaxy, one would assume that there's movement everywhere else in the universe, thus implying that the universe does move, right? There is a movement somehow. Why are we questioning that the universe does not spin? Is it static? Is it really static? I don't know.
Well, I definitely like the idea of a universe that spins. Like movement. Movement is fun. If travel back in time is impossible outside of spinning the universe and those paradoxes that you spoke about, why does the idea of time travel still appeal to us so much?
There's a bit of a romanticism around going back in time, right? Like wishing to either witness the past or influence the past or undo the past or whatever. There's a romanticized notion about it and a fantasy around it. So, and I think in that sense, it's appealing.
Oh, so kind of a melancholy about the past and wanting to change.
Yeah, why else would you want to go back in time?
You are listening to The Kaleidoscope Gallery. The Kaleidoscope Gallery.
Relax, killer robots haven't taken over yet. But the internet's going crazy over new artificial intelligence called ChatGPT. The program can write really complex essays, books, news articles, and even computer code. And it's really good. We just had to try it for ourselves, asking it to write a poem about this show. The Five on Fox News is quite a sight, with a panel that's always so bright. They entertain and inform with their banter and charm and have viewers tune in day and night.
Okay, here's part of a poem that was written by AI. Rising with the dawn, I stretch and yawn, ready to greet the day in my own special way. This was written by OpenAI's chatbot system called ChatGPT. It responds to pretty much anything you ask. It's an AI trained to recognize patterns in text pulled from the internet. It's further trained with help from humans to make the dialogue more useful. So let the adventure begin, and may the fun never end as I embrace each moment and let my spirit soar and ascend. Thanks, AI.
This is from an article in The Atlantic. The headline is, How ChatGPT Will Destabilize White-Collar Work. In the next 5 years, it is likely that AI will begin to reduce employment for college-educated workers. As the technology continues to advance, it will be able to perform tasks that were previously thought to require a high level of education and skill. It will be important for individuals to stay up to date on the latest developments in AI and to consider how their skills and expertise can be leveraged in a world where machines are increasingly able to perform many tasks. And the reason why I read that kind of generic opening to this article here is that paragraph itself, that was written by ChatGPT.
Okay, yeah.
It was inevitable that this technology would emerge. This generative, what's it?
Generative pre-trained transformer. So this chatbot, it's based on like massive amounts of language models, right? So, and it's still, it's continuing to be fine-tuned, or maybe it's fine-tuning itself, I don't know. There's a degree of accuracy to it, which I think is what's impressive for some people, but and a lot of like big companies like Microsoft slowly like integrating it into their systems. So, and schools are becoming very reticent about it. First of all, they need to understand what it can do, because apparently you can just ask it to write you an essay and then raises questions about, you know, opportunities to cheat. Where this will lead to, if this is their kind of their best swing at trying to get a more sophisticated level of AI, then maybe there's something to it, right?
Let me read you this. This is from Wikipedia. Although the core function of a chatbot is to mimic a human conversationalist, ChatGPT is versatile. For example, it can write and debug computer programs, compose music, teleplays, answer test questions, write poetry, and song lyrics.
It's, again, all the knowledge of this application or this chatbot is based on existing data, right? So, or what's available on the internet. So, naturally, it's, you know, it can certainly extrapolate and probably come up with conclusions and write a string or a string of quote-unquote music. I mean, really, what is that? What is that, really? Like, apart from, like, a derivative of something existing already, right? It's always a derivative of something. So, there's two things to be said. Yes, kudos to ChatGPT and, like, the pursuit of artificial intelligence, of trying to essentially attempt at having a machine think and process like a human, right? I mean, that's kind of far-fetched, but I think that seems like to be the goal.
Starts to fade. times that I felt safe. Like Christmas lights draping over my fireplace. Sad love concave me. Let me teach you the wicked ways I live.
So Hans, you're a songwriter, and we just heard one of your songs actually called Sad Love. How do you write your lyrics? Do you get lyrical ideas before you write the music, or is it the opposite, or is it some other way?
I usually just show up to the session and just freestyle over something that I've made, and then usually freestyling, I'll get a few strong ideas, and then I'll write down those ideas, and then basically fill in the blanks from there. And then it's all about what words usually sound the coolest, or what kind of vocal like style in it sounds attractive. And there's really not like a story. The story comes like after the kind of just bullshit freestyle, if that makes any sense.
Well, okay, yeah. When you say freestyle, to be clear, you mean like stream of consciousness, just completely off the top of your head.
So sometimes words will be like, I won't even say words, it'll just be like vowel sounds and shit like that.
So suggesting words you're trying to find a melody as well as words.
It's more of a melody, and then if you can get a melody in like three or four words, and like kind of just like an attitude. It's all just kind of like about the attitude in how you say or sing words. Because if you take someone else's lyrics from another song and you sing them, mm-hmm. you don't have the same cadence, attitude. Like there's so many dissimilarities between, like, if you were to just sing lyrics that this artist wrote, those lyrics work for their voice and the way they say things. Like, it might not work for your voice. So I try to just find words that work with my voice and then try to string some kind of story through there. But it's usually always like melancholic, uplifting, but also like recently I'm trying to do more just more fully uplifting. But yeah, I mean, it's all, everything's kind of a story and dramatic. It's all about drama.
Cinematic type drama or like emotions, deep emotions.
I was thinking about some words like, famous last words.
That's a good one. That's got weight and drama, as you say.
Something like if you were in the heat of an argument with a significant other, that kind of stuff. You know what I'm saying? Like just like very visceral and like unapologetically raw and sometimes like short-sighted, but very human.
We're good. You know what this is. Everyone knows what this is by now. The chatbot by OpenAI.
Mm.
And I thought it would be interesting because I was listening carefully to your process, your creative process. And typically, as a lot of artistic processes, it wasn't black and white. It was a discovery process for you, it seems. And it could take a lot of time. Whereas we can query the chatbot and right away, it'll write us some lyrics.
Yeah.
So I thought we'd put in that. What was that idea that you had, that first dramatic situation that you had three words for? It was like...
Oh, you mean famous last words?
That was it.
Sure.
So what if I type in, and I'll have to put my mic down to do this. I type in...
Famous last words?
All right, here we go. Well, even writing us a chorus. I'm going to read this. At least the first verse. Famous last words, spoken in haste. Promise forever, but nothing lasts. We said we'd always be, but now you're gone, leaving me with nothing but a love so strong. Now we get to hear the chorus kicking in. Famous last words echo in my head, reminding me of what we had. Famous last words, now a bitter taste, wishing I could go back to that first embrace. Maybe I'll read the outro. Famous last words spoken in the heat of the moment. But now they're just a reminder of our love that's forever broken. Damn, I'm going to cry.
Yeah, I think that these, we're talking about writing lyrics with the help of AI. I think just looking at it as far as like shit that actually sounds cool. I mean, I feel like Echo in My Head's cool. Now A Bitter Taste, that's cool. Like, it seems like 80% pretty shitty, but there are a couple of like cool kind of like little pieces that you could probably go. So it's almost like a thesaurus in this case. I feel like if this is the infancy, right? So you're going to get kind of a primary school nursery rhyme kind of thing going on. But I think it's definitely helpful. I mean, I kind of just think that this shit in general is kind of like the cohesion of Google.
Yeah.
And the internet in a conversation. And there's nothing wrong with that. It just kind of feels like Alexa thing, kind of thing. Like you ask Alexa, kind of feels a lot like that.
So fairly primitive.
My only other problem with it is it doesn't fucking do bad shit. Like you can't be like, I wanna like write an erotic novel about like Donald Trump and like Lady from The Little Mermaid. You know, the one like squid lord who's has like the weird triton or whatever. You can't get whack with it, which is like such a baseline need for humanity. It's like all the fun is stripped out of this thing.
Yeah, that's a great point. It says this on the page, the chat open AI says, trained to decline inappropriate requests. So that's what you're talking about.
Come on, what do you have to pay like the $5 extra per month to get that ban lifted? Yeah, so I was thinking about this and what it can't. I think it has a lot of positivity with like the conveying of information, but the tonality at which that it does so, that will evoke like emotional responses from humans, is, I'm not saying it's not possible, but I think it's further away than not further away. Just because there's just a certain tonality to human beings. And this is basically the sum of all the things on the internet, which is already not a super accurate reflection of humanity.
Before we part, let me leave you with a quote attributed to the 13th century Persian poet Rumi, which reads, "When love first tasted the lips of being human, it started singing." We hope you have enjoyed this excursion through the Kaleidoscope Gallery, and that you will join us next time.
You have been listening to the many colors of the Kaleidoscope Gallery.